Hello and welcome to this week's Dialects Radio. Well, it's a welcome return for me at least. I've been a little bit ill the past month, so thank you very much to Tony Gosling for standing in for me and presenting the show so excellently over the past few weeks. The show's come to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and Preston and all over the world accessing the show on the internet. Our guest this week is John DeMearns, an artist from Southville, and we're going to chat to him in a minute. We're hoping to hear from Ed Hill about the latest developments happening over in the Middle East with the convoy. And our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Charles Thompson gives us his tips for the Football World Cup. Malcolm Grieve reads an episode of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. And Trevor Carter, the bard of Windmill Hill on Dialect Radio, our resident bard, reads his latest poem. Jeff Sparks is also back in the studio with a What's On guide and a song of the week. I'm John Peters Coleman, and it's my pleasure to introduce an artist from Southville to the studio. Hello, John.
Hello.
So you are an artist of many kinds. Tell me a little bit about how you started getting into art and what your various disciplines are that you engage in.
Well, I first started making art when I was 17, actually, I quickly discovered that printmaking was definitely my area of interest, and so I studied my BAs and MAs and spent plenty of years printmaking, and then. About 13 years ago, I came back to Bristol and started. I was kind of making a lot of different work then, mostly painting and some sculpture. When I got a studio at Spike Island, that was my initial training.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like, sort of going into Spike Island, or what it was like being there, because it's a place that a lot of people probably would have heard of, but don't really know what it is.
Spike, yeah, Spike. Yeah. Spike's interesting. Spike. Well, it's Spike. Actually, the word is synonymous with anyone who's been to prison. If they say I've been to Spike, it's synonymous with prison going. But it's not quite a prison. I was actually in the building we inhabited before the one we're in at the moment. On Cumberland Road.
Right.
And that building is, still crumbling with some kind of strange brick disease. But we all moved into our current location on 133 Cumberland Road. I think it was about 13 years ago.
What is the sense of community like there?
It's interesting. It can be quite fiery. It's good, though. It's a good place. It's gone through a lot of changes certainly in the last 5 or 6 years, with some lot of redevelopment and interesting new people coming in to run the place or leaving.
When you say printmaking, tell me a little bit about what interested you about printmaking. Are we sort of talking? I'm imagining sort of a William Caxton style big press.
Initially, yeah. I mean, that was kind of what intrigued me initially. But I think what fascinates me about printmaking is I love the creative process. I love working with brushes and inks and colours and form and very spontaneous, very immediate work. And the joy with printmaking is that when you start making marks, you can do them in one place and then quickly you can work all in kind of one movement on a whole piece. When you're painting, you're working with just the space that the brush touches the picture. Mm. With a print, you can work over the whole area of the picture, and you have these fantastic reveal moments where you can literally kind of peel back the plate or peel back the paper, and cha-ching, there you go. You've got a completely changed or altered piece of work. And I really enjoy that process of immediacy and reveal. And it's kind of that... It's those sort of sensations and those interests that have kind of carried my work through the different transformations it's been through in the last few years.
Right. Does that have a much commercial application in what you do?
Or? What I do at the moment, well, I've been exploring what I do for quite a long time. And, the last major kind of commercial work I did was... Oh, it's kind of slightly ongoing. Is a big commission I did for the Royal Nice Hospital in Bath. That's kind of how I got into making glasswork. In fact, I got the commission without ever having cut a piece of glass in my life, which was.
How did you flag that? Well, did you flag that one then?
It wasn't too much of a blag. They really liked the idea that I kind of offered them as a kind of means of celebrating people who gave to their appeal, and embodying them in mythological animals. And I was confident that I could realise that.
Okay.
And I have. So, yeah.
So embodying mythological creatures in glass?
No, embodying the spirit of people giving to an appeal, to a hospital appeal. Every hospital in the country has an appeal, an ongoing charitable appeal. That's how they raise money to really kind of equip the hospital often.
Mm.
So buying new CT scanners or big bits of kit and stuff. So, and each of those appeals has lots of people who give to it, whether that's kind of nurses sort of going on a fun run or people wearing the wrong trousers or whatever. So what they wanted to do was celebrate all the people who were giving to these appeals. So there were thousands of people they wanted to celebrate. So I embodied them in various different kind of reworkings of mythological animals. So unicorns, winged lions. The last piece I made was a griffin, which was a Weimaraner dog's body with a puffin's head. They're big glassworks, substantial glassworks, fused glassworks. And then all the people who'd given over the period of time that each one celebrates, their names are sandblasted in front, sort of 16,000 characters.
Wow.
So, that's how I got into glass, but I still make glasswork and I still make leaded glasswork and sort of lead lights, but I'm really interested in silver staining and enamelling. So whilst that's been a vehicle for me to sort of study and get into glass and to realise some money, it's been a real opportunity to start really exploring the chemistry of glass and the potential for printmaking on it.
What sort of potential do you see in glass? I mean, some obviously sort of visual arts are very well explored. How do you feel glass is an art?
Well, interesting. I guess that reflects back on... my experience of moving into glass had a kind of strange ambivalence about it, because on the one hand I suddenly found that I'd had this amazing material I could suddenly work with, which had no opacity, because as a printmaker you're always working with paper or wood or whatever, but you can't see through it. Suddenly I had glass and you could just work with colour directly, immediately. So that was really exciting, but at the same time, glass is really not treated like a noble material by the fine arts. It's kind of quite dismissed. It's considered to be, a bit of a second class material, I suppose. It's kind of a craft material, or an applied arts material, and it's bizarrely almost ousted from my studio because I was said to be doing applied art as opposed to fine art.
I mean,
it's got a strange status.
What sort of finesse in control of the form can you have in glass as opposed to, say, sculpture? You can control sculpture down to the finest detail, but glass, the image I have in my mind is obviously the great long tube and then you blow and puff away and then a big bowl comes out at the end.
No, I don't do any of that.
Right, okay.
That's glass blowing.
Right. Okay.
There's a lot of different things you can do with glass. I essentially work with flat glass, and I'm either using coloured glasses, which are pre-made, pre-coloured, using various different chemicals, or I'm using clear glass. And I use specific clear glasses which they're very white. They're very, very clear. Often, when you look at glass, if you look at it from the side, you can see it's very green. It's because it's got a lot of iron in it. But
right.
I use a low iron glass, which means it's much clearer. It's much kind of whiter.
Okay. What sort of stuff have you got coming up soon? Have you got any publicly exhibited works in there?
Yeah, I've got I'll be doing the Art on the Hill, I guess, probably in Wimmer Hill, but that's not until October.
And that's a sort of like an arts trail.
Yeah, it's a really good local arts trail.
Okay,
it's hot on the tail of various other Bristol art trails.
Yeah,
but it's good fun. It's a good kind of community event.
Anything else? Do you have an online presence yet?
That's kind of what I'm focusing on at the moment. I've been doing a lot of teaching work and a lot of different small glass commissions. But I'm just about to launch my own website, and we'll see.
Excellent. So if you search for John de Mearns, M-E-A-R-N-S, and Google or your other favourite search engine soon.
Yeah, you'll definitely stumble across what I'm up to.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming in, and best of luck, and thank you for sharing that with us.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for calling me.
Our next track is from a double CD called Sahara, and the track is called Compagnie Miscaoui. Was Compagnie Miscaoui from a CD called Sahara. You will have noticed in the press, of course, about the Israeli commando attack on a Gaza relief flotilla in the early hours of last Sunday. And a man who's been in the news a lot is Ed Hill, commenting on it, and he's on the line now. Hello, Ed. I'm speaking to Ed Hill, the coordinator of the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Hello.
Yes, and a foot in both camps as well. There's also Bristol-Gaza link. You know, we're working closely together in this, you know, stressful time.
Mm. I mean, we've had members of the Bristol-Gaza link on our show before, so this is sort of doubly shocking in some ways. How many English people do we know are aboard the boat? That
numbers on many things are not very exact. I mean, as regards how many British people, I've seen the figures of sort of 30 or 40, something in that range anyway. But because there was a number of different groups coming together very rapidly with different boats, and IHH, in the aid organisation in Turkey, would have an accurate list of who's on board their boat. But obviously we haven't got full information on the whole national picture. But speaking for the West Country here, you will have heard about the two Bristol men.
Yeah.
Cliff Hanley, he's age 61, he's retired and an artist living in Southville, and Shakir Yidrorim, who supports himself and his family running a kebab stall in Fishponds, which is quite well known in the local area.
Right.
And he's 41, married with three children, and lives in East Bristol.
Right.
Looking slightly wider around our area, and we've just been sort of chasing up on these things. There's Ibrahim Masaji, who is a social care worker in Gloucester, and he's also a member of Bristol-Gaza Link and was actually going over on their behalf as part of this aid flotilla. And then finally, there's a fourth person, or at least their parents, a young female, a aid worker, and her parents live in Wiltshire. So as far as we know, four people from the West Country.
Okay, so what sort of things were they taking? I understand cement was on board the ship, and presumably aid and...
Well, certainly the fundraising exercise that I was involved in with our local group here in Bristol, we were doing street stalls for about the last 5-6 weeks in various shopping centres around Bristol, and also doing donations of peels at churches and mosques and to organisations and individuals. Good people of Bristol put their hands in their pockets and understand the injustice of what's happening in Gaza. So all in all, we actually raised about £6,000, which was fabulous. And certainly our stalls around the shopping centres down in Broadmead and such like, you know, people will come across and they put money into the tin because they know how awful things are in Gaza and they want to help. And that money was going over to the IHH project to buy cement and building materials to take to Gaza. Now, in addition to that, our two people, we were stuffing their luggage with laptop computers, small presents for the people in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And also I know that Shakir had in his pocket a wad of notes that had been given to him by somebody at his mosque, the Turkish mosque on Gloucester Road, specifically to take to the orphanage in Gaza that had been visited by the people on the convoy at Christmas time.
Okay, so.
And the distressing stories of the young children there who'd been injured and lost their family in the terrible bombings.
But not as far as you're aware, any weaponry, because of course the Israeli commandos said that...
Well, of course not. No. I mean, you know, these are only ordinary people, you know, here in Bristol, you know, caring people who have been putting their... I mean, Shakir and Cliff paid their own travel expenses over to Turkey to have a chance to go on the boat to visit Gaza again. And you know, these are only just ordinary people. And I have to say, the spin that's coming out you know, from other places, you know, sometimes paints these people as troublemakers or do-gooders going around stumbling into danger. And
okay.
I'm afraid if people just use their common sense, they realise that these are the... These are ordinary people here in Bristol, in our city, trying to do the right thing.
Do you feel, I mean, if this is obviously such a publicity-owned goal for Israel, I mean, what is the motivation for it? I mean, it's damaged their relationship with Turkey quite strongly, so why did they do it?
Well, it took me by surprise. I had a phone call at 6 a.m. on Monday morning. To be honest, I thought there'd be some sort of standoff at sea. After all, the boats were in international waters. You know, I've heard reports that they'd actually turned round when confronted by the Israeli Navy, but I, like many people, just couldn't believe that something of this magnitude, this brutality and awfulness, would have happened. But the phone call came from a Palestinian living here in Bristol, and I have to say, the penny suddenly dropped that the Palestinian people have been suffering terrible losses in a variety of ways over a long period of time. If you think of the massacres in the refugee camps in Lebanon, 2002, 2003, the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank that was bulldozed with people still in their houses, the daily death toll, the war on southern Lebanon in 2006, which left over 1,000 people dead and wanton destruction of civilian infrastructure, and then finally the attacks on Gaza before last. And in fact, there is a track record of doing this. The only thing that's new is I don't think this large number of internationals have been wiped out in this sort of numbers. No, we don't know exactly what the numbers are, but the sort of scale ever before.
I mean, do you think it was deliberate that it was in international waters? I mean, that does make the legality a sort of grey area.
I'm just a naive, ordinary, you know, campaigner, and I sort of always hope that everyone is trying to help for the common good. But the penny's beginning to drop that actually this could even have been premeditated, and that's an awful thing to say.
Mm.
But why else would it have happened? Why was the ship challenged in international waters? And, I mean, some of your listeners may know some of the history to this. The Free Gaza movement... a couple of years ago, we're sending in sort of small boats with peace activists on board. The first two or three maybe got in, and then the subsequent three were threatened at sea by the Navy. And certainly one of them, I know from a medical person here from the southwest, was on board a boat that was actually rammed by the Israeli Navy. And that's a pretty awful thing to do, but it is at least non-lethal.
Yeah, I mean, what do you
think... So why couldn't that have been done in this circumstance?
What do you think this says for the future of the Bristol-Palestine Solidarity Campaign and the Bristol-Gaza Link? Because, do you think more aid convoys are going to go there?
That's certainly the talk. I mean, can I just mention, there are still one or two ships that are still on their way. The ship named the Rachel Corrie, which left Ireland about 2 weeks ago, maybe it was behind schedule, it's still on its way and is due to reach Gaza waters within the next day or two.
Okay, so we've still got news upcoming about what might happen about
that. There is still more to come, and I have full marks to those people. They must be incredibly brave if they continue on their voyage knowing what's happened to those who went before.
All right, well, I'm going to have to stop you then, unfortunately, because we've run out of time. But Ed Hill, thank you very much for chatting to us about that.
Thank you very much, too.
And, you know, we'll hear more about that in the coming weeks. And hopefully we'll speak to you again.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Next feature is courtesy of Tony Gosling. This is Norman Finkelstein. This is the voice you are going to hear. He's a Jewish historian from New York. And these are his comments on the Israeli commando attack on the early hours of last Sunday on the Gaza relief flotilla.
So far, there's been a pretty mild statement by President Obama regretting what happened, saying it should be investigated. But not going beyond that, I would call it a mild a mild display of concern. I think there are many things that need to be said, and there has to be serious thought given to what's happened. Let's start from the basics. Israel was imposing an illegal blockade on Gaza, what was called by Amnesty International last week a flagrant violation of international law. The United Nations Committee of Elders, people like Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, they just distributed a statement today in which they called the blockade of Gaza one of the worst human rights violations in the world today. Number two, Israel attacked a humanitarian convoy in international waters. They used armed commandos to attack an international, or I should say a humanitarian convoy in international waters. I think everyone can agree that there's no possibility, there's no way to justify using armed force against what were clearly unarmed humanitarians trying to relieve an illegal siege of Gaza. But to me, the more important question is this. Namely, during Israel's massacre in Gaza, December 2008 and January 2009, afterwards, Israeli officials were saying that they wanted to show the Arab world that they were capable of acting like a lunatic state and like mad dogs, that they wanted to restore the Arab world's fear of Israel. And that's why they acted like a lunatic state and like mad dogs in Gaza. But after yesterday's events, we really have to ask the question, is Israel acting like a lunatic state, or has it become a lunatic state? And that's not just rhetoric. What happened with the Gaza flotilla was not an accident. You have to remember that the Israeli cabinet met for fully a week. All the cabinet ministers discussed and deliberated how they would handle the flotilla. There were numerous reports in the Israeli press, numerous suggestions, numerous recommendations about what to do. At the end of the day, they decided on a nighttime armed commando raid on a humanitarian convoy. Israel is now a lunatic state. It's a lunatic state with between 200 and 300 nuclear devices. It is threatening war daily against Iran and against the Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah in Lebanon has already stated on several occasions that if Israel attacks, it will retaliate in kind. Things are getting out of control. We have to ask ourselves a simple, basic, fundamental question. Can a lunatic state like Israel be trusted with 200 to 300 nuclear devices when it is now threatening its neighbors, Iran and Lebanon, with an attack?
Well, thank you very much to Tony Gosling and to Norman Finkelstein for his comments there. The song The Watch It Sailor is a folk song by Tom and Barbara Brown from their album West Country Night Out. Eager-eared listeners will have noticed we've played it before on Dialect, but this time we're going to use it as an introduction to the next feature by Anthea Page, which is an interview with some members of the Ilfracombe Lifeboat Station.
As I was walking down Watchet Swain Street, a jolly old shipmate I chanced for to meet. Hello, brother sailor, you're welcome to home. In season to Watchet, I think you are come. Now don't you remember once courting a maid? Now through your long absence, she's going to be wed. Tomorrow in Bristol, this wedding's to be, and I am invited. invited, the same for to see. Jack went and got license that very same night, and walked into Bristol as soon as 'twas light. He sat in the temple churchyard for a while, till he saw the bride coming, which caused him to smile. Went and he took this fair maid by the hand. You're going to be married, as I understand. Well, if you are to marry, then you'll be my bride, and I have come here.
We're here at the Ilfracombe lifeboat station.
What's your name?
David Clements.
Tell us about the lifeboat.
Well, it's an all-weather boat, the Mersey class. It's the number's 12007, and it's an all-weather lifeboat, so it can go in any weather, any state of the tides, to rescue life.
What interesting incidents have you had today?
Well, believe it or not, we've been out for two casualties on a yacht. A young 12-year-old that was being seasick, suffering from cold, and the other guy was an older chap. He was suffering from seasick, probably a bit of hypothermia with that guy. He wasn't dressed for the occasion. The Swansea Coast Guard tasked the lifeboat, and we went down to off a ball point about 3.5 miles and went alongside and got the casualties back, gave him one of the guys oxygen and brought him back to Ilfracombe safely.
So what's your name?
Alex.
And are you a cox?
No, I'm the boathouse manager.
And have you had any serious casualties amongst your crew? Because you're volunteers, aren't you?
We're all volunteers, yeah. And in the 6 years that I've been here, we've had no casualties among the crew.
What's the most dangerous incident?
Well, it all depends, really. You don't really know what you're going to as a lifeboatman until you get down to the station. And then sometimes information can't be as good as you'd like it. And it all depends exactly what the weather conditions are. Once you go out the boathouse and you're in the arbour, the elements are against you. It could be a force, 8, 9, something like that, possibly more. And that's what you've got to go into. So it could be difficult conditions. Sometimes it's reasonably calm and you've still got to go out to find somebody who's lost or in the water, or people overdo. Anything could be happening. You just don't know until you get down there, really.
And what training do you have?
My training is trained on house here. I listen to the coxswains and the crew members and they train me up. But otherwise, I do research myself on the Ilfracombe life and lifeboat and the RNLI.
If I was in distress at sea, who would I speak to out of you two?
Hopefully the information would be given to Swansea Coast Guard to actually launch us, the Ilfracombe lifeboat, if you were around our area, and then we would take it from there. So I would end up talking to you, or all depends what the situation was, really. So if you were in a little boat or something, you haven't got a radio, you got a telephone, we can't talk to you, so Swansea would. If you've got a VHF radio, eventually Swansea would hopefully be talking to you, and then we'd pick you up and we'd get there. If you didn't know where you were or something like that, we've got a DF set on there, a direction finder, that we could listen to you, and that would come up on a compass and give us a direction to actually go and pick you up.
Let's talk about the boat. How much would one of these boats cost?
No, because, she's up to 20-year-old now, but, you're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds just for a refit. I think you're talking 200,000-odd pounds, which is take it down, take it off station, put a relief boat here, and then go through all the works, all the maintenance, rip everything out and start again. So, new... I still think it's probably, when she was built, nearly $500,000.
So who provides the money for the lifeboat?
This is all raised by the fundraisers, which there's thousands of them around the country. Like today, we've done the boot sale. All that money comes into Ilfracombe and is used in the RNLI for all sorts of things. Things that the actual boathouse need, that money goes into a kitty and is used there.
So what's the nearest coast guard from here?
Well, we've got our own auxiliary coast guards here, Ilfracombe, but it used to be manned, Ilfracombe Coast Guard, so now it's all done from Swansea. It's about 25 mile from Ilfracombe, straight across the sea to the north. So they're a fair ways away, but they actually control most of the Bristol Channel, really, 99% of it. And then from there on, it's Milford Avon.
So would they control Weston and Clevedon?
Yes, they do. Yeah, that's right, they do. All done from Swansea. Basically, that's it. And when we go to Milford Avon on the west coast of Wales, and then if you come on the north coast again, you go down to Falmouth, Padstow side of things, and that is done from Falmouth. So, yeah, so it's all from Swansea, from us.
So are you allocated an area of sea? What's the furthest north and south that you go from here?
We can go anywhere where we're tasked to go, actually, but we've all got patches and sort of like boundaries. But then again, on the all-weather boat might be needed instead of a D-class lifeboat from another station and things like that. If it gets too much from, you know, the conditions change, so it's an all-weather job.
Well, I'm going upstairs now in the lifeboat station. I'm actually going to go on board the lifeboat. How exciting is that? Oh, wow. It's quite a big boat, isn't it? And a bright orange cockpit. Why is that?
Well, that's the colour because it's easy seen out at sea. So the casualty can see the boat coming from quite some distance away. Orange is the colour that stands out the most in the sea and against the sky, as you get so many different colours, especially in the summer. But the boat stands out okay.
So can we go down into...
You can. Be careful how you go down. It'd be better to go down backwards.
Okay. Well, I've gone down the steps into the actual control room. We've got a chart table here.
Yes.
Who sits here then?
This is where the navigator sits. He navigates to the incident and in contact with the coxswain who's taking the boat forward. People are fine by this. You know, this is their
marine chart
where it's of the Bristol Channel in the area we cover. And of course, the radio op as well. He works for VHF and radios and UHF. HF as well, but HF is now almost obsolete. It's not used anymore a lot, really. When it's up to a force 8, 9 and above, the crew are all got to be inside the boat, sealed in the boat. And the coxswain, as you can see, controls the boat from the left-hand side of the boat, which is the port side of the boat, right? He can control from here. They're all strapped in, of course, then, and the boat is sealed. The Mersey is a self-righting boat, so if they're out in a force 10, you know, they could be easily knocked over by a wave. So they're all sealed in. It's watertight. If it does turn over, then they're all safe because they're strapped in. And it usually takes about 6 seconds to right itself again.
Have you ever been on board when that's happened?
No, I haven't. I'm not a crew member. I wouldn't like to be on board when it happens.
If someone's badly injured at sea and you get them on board, what emergency equipment have you got to deal with medical injuries?
Well, there's everything. There's oxygen, there's all this stuff. There's a stretcher on here for one person. The crew are able to do that because they're trained in first aid, and we have a couple of paramedics anyway on the crew. It's fully covered, but they do go through the training down in Poole at our college in Dorset. Each crew member goes there for about 3 or 4 weeks originally. The training is ongoing all the time. When they're back at the station, it never stops.
People probably don't realise how easy it is to drown. More incidents at sea than anything else, would you say?
Yes, there is.
So would people die of drowning quicker than hypothermia?
Hypothermia can come in quite quick. One incident was over at Rapparee Rocks. A local fisherman went fishing. His wife had just bought him one of these new suits that had been designed for fishermen, which are watertight, and it was January. He knew what he was doing. His local fishing had been doing it for years, but a freak wave come and washed him in. Now, if it hadn't been for that suit, he would have been dead in 7 minutes. Because of the low temperature of the tide in January, he wouldn't have lasted very long at all. So the suit actually saved his life. It took the crew 7 minutes to get from here to him. And lucky enough, he was saved. He was very grateful.
If a call went out now, how long would it take to get the boat actually into the sea from here?
Right. Somebody would pick up the phone and phone in an incident, and they'd be put through straight to Swansea Coast Guard. Then Swansea Coast Guard will get in touch with our launch officer. Every station has got a launch officer. And the launch officer is the one who decides which boat goes out to the incident. And then, after he's decided which one goes, he rings the pagers, and the coxswain's pager will go first. He'll be coming here first, and then the crew. All that time, it never takes longer for the all-weather lifeboat, no longer, and doesn't matter if the tide's out or right out or in, no longer than 15 minutes.
So do the crew live locally then?
Yes, they all live within 5 or 10 minutes walking from the boathouse.
And is it difficult to recruit people?
No, not at all. We often get young lads coming in. We're turning them away because we've got enough crew and enough on the waiting list to get in.
So how much time do they spend manning the lifeboats?
an example of Ilfracombe lifeboat. We had, I think, 43 shouts last year. 14 or 16 of them were the all-weather boat and the rest were the inshore. So the inshore lifeboat is the workhorse of the RNLI. The all-weather boat is powered by two Caterpillar engines, 285 shaft horsepower. It gives a power of 17 knots. I know it doesn't sound very fast, but 20 mile an hour in the water is quite fast. This will be replaced soon with a new boat because it's 20 years old. The all-weathers are only in service for 20 years and then they're auctioned off. Usually the highest bidder will take it.
Does each member have to know how to drive the boat?
Well, obviously, yes, because if there was a really bad accident and six of the crew were injured, there's seven crew altogether, that's counting the coxswain. Well, if six of those, or five of those crew members and the coxswain were hurt, the other crewmen would be able to retrieve the boat and get it back safely. But the difference is with the coxswain is going in on really bad weather and he has the experience to control the boat getting near to other vessels. Because if you can imagine 30-foot or 20-foot waves, it'll be quite difficult to get near to the boat to rescue the survivors of the boat.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been supporting the RNL since 2005.
What's the worst or most dramatic incident that you've come across in that time?
Probably the fishermen that got knocked off, but then I don't know because I don't go out to sea, so I only go what the report goes up on the board or in the service book. Oh, and 2 years ago when we had the two young lads that were cut off by the tide round Rapree, and our youngest crew member at the time was Jackie, was 17, and he risked his life because it was quite a choppy sea out there. He risked his life by jumping in to get to the two young lads, secure them with lifeboats so that they could be towed back to the inshore and brought back safely. So it doesn't matter what age you are, you know, they're trained so well down at Poole that the training just clicks in. So they forget fear, they just go on, carry on with the job that they're trained to do.
Real heroes.
They are, yes, I think so. That's why I support them.
Well, thank you very much to the members of the Ilfracombe Lifeboat Station in North Devon for sharing their time. Thank you to Anthony Page. And there's another part of that. You can hear part two and a wrecker's tale coming up in dialect in a few weeks' time. It's over to Malcolm Greaves, straight out of Swindon, for another instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell.
Secrets and Lies, dredged up by David Southwell. The police often ask the public to report liars and inform them of any secret illegal activity they've discovered. But in this section, the position is reversed, as the things they do their best to keep hidden are exposed to the public. From alliances with the mafia and collusion with terrorists, to efforts to suppress information on their flawed investigative processes, there is a lot the bastions of justice do not want us to know about. We expect criminals to be experts at keeping secrets and telling lies. But it seems that when it comes to crime, they are rivaled by those entrusted with keeping law and order, those who have a lot to hide, and who are expert at generating falsehoods themselves. Unless you are a career criminal or have been unjustly treated by those in the legal system, it is unlikely that you will share the above view of the police and judiciary. We're culturally conditioned to reject ideas such as the FBI and Scotland Yard regularly lying to us as crazy. However, the more you uncover the truth about those responsible for delivering justice, the more it becomes clear that one of the biggest lies our society is bought into is the idea that those in the legal system would never deceive us because their only concern is protecting us from criminals. This widespread cultural myth has made it easy for corrupt elements to break the law and send many innocent people to jail. It has been called the most subversive secret of the judicial system, and campaigners in America have been arrested for doing nothing more than telling people the information you are about to hear. The truth is that many in the courts do not want the public to know that juries have a right to judge the law, and can decide to acquit a defendant even if the defendant has broken the law. The knowledge that a jury can acquit even if all the evidence proves someone has broken a law and can decide cases on grounds other than the facts involved means that they can effectively put a law itself on trial. The right to do this is known as jury nullification, and it exists in both English and American law. Members of the American Fully Informed Jury Association have been prosecuted for handing out literature containing quotes such as those of Lord Denham in the case of O'Connell versus Rex, in which he said, "Every jury in the land is tampered with and falsely instructed by the judge when it is told that it must accept as law that which has been given to them, or that they can decide only the facts in the case." This directly contradicts the words used by almost every judge when instructing juries as to how to proceed with making a judgment on a case. In 1969, the Fourth Circuit Court of the Appeal in the US judged, "If a jury feels a law unjust, we recognize the undisputed power of the jury to acquit, even if the verdict is contrary to the law given by the judge and contrary to the evidence." Jury nullification has played a strong role in the history of the public refusing to accept unjust laws. It was used in the American colonies to free people the British had brought to trial for speaking ill of the king. In recent years, some juries have exercised the right and refused to convict users of marijuana for medical purposes and anti-war protesters. No wonder some want the truth suppressed. It has become known as the CSI effect, after the TV crime drama CSI, Crime Scene Investigation. A belief by juries, judges, lawyers and detectives that DNA evidence is infallible and incontrovertible proof of guilt if produced by prosecutors at court. Presented as the greatest revolution in forensic science since the introduction of fingerprints, DNA is seen by the public and the majority of forensic scientists as a magic bullet that is always capable of delivering an infallible verdict. It is meant to convict the guilty and free innocent victims of earlier miscarriages of justice. Experts have produced statistics that claim the chances of a DNA match occurring by chance are more than 1 in a billion. With those odds, no wonder it is a piece of evidence that is rarely challenged, and a process that has inspired higher public confidence in the judicial process in rape and murder trials. The truth is that public confidence in DNA evidence being an infallible indicator of guilt or innocence is highly misplaced. Independent tests into the forensic use of DNA showed that 1 in 100 may give a false result, making the odds of a false DNA match considerably lower than the quoted 1 in a billion. Researchers asked labs to match a series of DNA samples. They knew which ones were from the same person, but found that human error led to the wrong result in 12 in every 1,000 tests. In secret tests on 135 labs carried out by the College of American Pathologists, they discovered that 14 of the labs completely botched the process. In 1 year, in just one US state, Seattle, 23 major crime investigations were shown to have been affected by misleading genetic evidence, including one where bungling scientists had accidentally contaminated the clothing of a 10-year-old rape victim with DNA from another case they were working on. Despite such evidence, British government scientists say that errors are impossible, and the UK's Forensic Science Service claims no mistakes are allowed to go to court. When Osama bin Laden is captured, the American authorities should hope it doesn't happen when he makes a trip to Switzerland to withdraw some funds from the bank accounts he has in Geneva. The last time Swiss authorities captured a known terrorist making a withdrawal, they allowed him to disappear from the cell he was being held in within 72 hours. The disappearing prisoner was Licio Gelli, wanted by Italian authorities for his involvement in two of the major scandals that rocked Italy in the early 1980s. He was directly linked to the collapse of the Vatican Bank subsidiary Banco Ambrosiano and was the key player behind the P2 Masonic Lodge's involvement in sponsoring terrorism. In particular, he was being sought for funding the bombing of Bologna Central Railway Station in 1980 that killed 80 people and left 200 maimed. The bombing was initially blamed on Red Brigades, but it soon emerged that far-right terrorists were really responsible. The bombers were part of the Gladio network set up by the CIA after the Second World War to ensure that Italy never fell under communist rule. former SS Oberlieutenant Jelly had been the man recruited to run Gladio. He also set up the P2 Lodge. Jelly, who had been on the run since 1981, was caught trying to withdraw $60 million from his Swiss numbered accounts. He had entered the country on an Argentinian passport under the name Bruno Rizzi, but was nabbed at the Geneva branch of the prestigious Bank of Switzerland. Taken into custody, Jelly was held for extradition to Italy on terrorism, conspiracy and fraud charges in the Champ d'Olon prison. Within 72 hours, he had disappeared from his cell and fled back to Argentina. Despite the natural anger of the Italian government, Swiss authorities refused any inquiry into the matter except the local police investigation, which found no evidence that Jelly had been helped to escape. All documents relating to the escape remain classified. The Swiss authorities refuse any comment except that Swiss police are the most incorruptible in the world.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve for reading another instalment of Secrets and Lies there, and thank you to David Southwell. Charles Thompson's here now for his betting tips on who is going to win the World Cup, and he's talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling.
As the great cult of the World Cup looms on the horizon, thousands and thousands of hours and hours and hours of commentators telling us all about all the various teams and players again and again, we thought on Dialect what we'd like to do is something which is reasonably short, so you don't have to spend hours and hours watching all these various commentators talking about the players and the tips of who's going to win. So I'm joined by Charles Thompson, who's an ex-BBC reporter, has done some... 400, I think you said, Charles?
400, yes, certainly 400. Could have been a few more, could have been a few less.
But Radio
football reports for various little stations like BBC Radio Lancashire and things like that, Brentford matches, Gillingham matches, Dover Athletic matches, you know, fantastic stuff.
Okay, so let's have our quick capsule review of about the players, really.
The players, I can talk about England. I can't really talk about Mexico or other teams.
No, that's
England,
fine.
So we've got loads and loads of problems, First of all, who's going to be the goalkeeper? That's a big problem. We've got three goalkeepers and we don't know if they're going to be reliable. So Green, Hart and James. So we don't know which one is going to be really able to hold out and hold strong.
So is this going to be a sort of experimental crash test of the different goalkeepers live as part of the World Cup?
It's all he can do, really. He's just put in someone he thinks is going to be okay.
But why is it that they haven't actually organised that then, do you think?
Well, we haven't had goalkeepers for some time now, a really confident and strong goalkeeper, stable goalkeeper. We used to have these people. We used to have Banks, we used to have Clements, we used to have Shilton, but we haven't got a really, really strong, reliable goalkeeper that's 100%, and we haven't had one for ages. So we've got good goalkeepers. We're not quite sure if they're going to blunder or not. They all have blundered in the past, and so we're going to be on the edge of our seats with our goalkeepers.
That's not a good start, is it?
Not really, no. Anyway, let's move on. Hopefully they won't have too much business. And then we've got a problem with the centre-halves. Okay, there's the middle of the defence, because one guy called Rio Ferdinand, yeah, Manchester United, he's been injured for a long time, so will he recover from his injury? Ledley King is a great, great player, but he's got a permanent knee problem, so his mobility is suffering. Ferdinand, by the way, has been described as wooden, whereas he used to be lithe and mobile. So, you know, do you want a wooden centre-half? Fantastic, robust, strong Liverpool player, has come back, but he's 32. And we've got this wonderful... Oh, those are the centre-backs. We've got Upson and Dawson, so big problems about who to pick and who to play. John Terry, of course, he's been injured. Then we've got problems with the left-back. We've got this very, very exciting Brazilian-type player called Glenn Johnson, who scored a wonderful, wonderful goal against Mexico a couple of weeks ago. And he beat four people and curled in a lovely shot. But unfortunately, he's not that good defensively. So you have to think, well, can we trust him? And then in the midfield against Mexico, we had this terrible problem with Michael Carrick, who's one of our silky, elegant players, playing very badly. He's lost all his confidence. So what can we do? And Barry is injured and Milner's not playing very well. And so we've got problems there. But But we have got Walcott and Lennon playing well, and Crouch is playing well, and Rooney, of course. But I'm really not that confident, but you never know. But
Fingers crossed.
I think quarterfinals. But
we'll be rooting for England, obviously.
I'll give you my top tips.
What are your real
my
tips?
Top
Who do you think's
top
really
tips are Brazil, as always. Spain have got a fantastic side. They won the European Cup. They are a really, really great team. Strong everywhere and very talented. Argentina are very good. And for my outsider, take it at 66-1, is Ivory Coast.
Okay. Really?
Yeah. They're good. They're very good. They're strong. And they've got Drogba. Yeah. So and they're used to the heat and playing in South Africa. So everyone says really when I say Ivory Coast. But if you're going to have an outsider, people are going to say really, aren't they? And you could have many other outsiders. One team not to back, they are the longest odds of all and regarded as the weakest team. Do you know which team this might be? You haven't a clue, have you?
It's not England. Is
not England, no. New Zealand. New Zealand are not worth putting any money on at all to do anything.
Okay, so yeah. If you had to actually say these people really are going to win, is it just Brazil? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, Brazil, Spain, Argentina okay. are the three, I think.
And which of those three? Come on.
I must have mentioned Germany. They always do well in cups. Well, let me think now. Spain.
Okay.
Thanks, Tony and Charles. So, Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and Dalek Radio. Hello.
Hi there, John. Good to see you back.
Oh, thank you very much.
Are
thank you.
You. Totally fighting fit again now.
I am, yes. A little bit tired, but I'm all right.
We've missed you so much.
Oh, well, what's the week been like in the news?
Well, this is about the bureaucracy of modern life, and specifically in the context of educational world.
Okay.
So, yeah, because I got a little bit of part-time work at present. But it's been a bureaucratic nightmare to
okay.
to get through it all because I'm actually employed by a college through an agency who then employ another agency to pay me my money who I have to pay money to so they pay me.
Yeah, that makes sense, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
you vented your spleen through the
Yeah,
poetry.
So it's very aggravating, really. And I call this the application process. There's quite a lot of acronyms in here, which I suppose if you're not in the educational or social work world, you may not be familiar with, but, you know.
Well, we're aware with it.
The application process. Have you paid the CRB to prove your innocence to me? Have you been Ofsted inspected? Has your thinking been corrected? Are you logged with GTC, as this is critical, you see? Have you joined the IFL? Have you secrets you should tell? Where was your grandmother born? Why is your application torn? Have you diseases to confess? Tick the boxes. Answer yes. Why are there gaps in your CV? What did you do in 93? If we offer you employment, will you give up all enjoyment? Will you work extra hours unpaid to prove that you can make the grade and keep your CPD updated with actions you've initiated? Will you sacrifice weekends and all the hours the good Lord sends? I trust you'll be enthusiastic, but must accept jobs are elastic. We offer no secure positions. Will you accept these kind conditions? In modern times, we must ensure the recruitment process will procure only those keen to comply. Do I see a tear form in your eye? In the brave new world of education, you must suspend imagination. Fill in the forms and play the game. So, what's your mother's maiden name?
And no appearance by Trevor will be complete without an advert for a cabaret. What have you got for us coming up?
Yes, the cabaret is the 11th of June, and an especially fantastic lineup.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got barbershop singers, we've got comedy, we've got wonderful music, and everything. Dancers from Bath.
Okay, will it be at the Lansdowne?
It's at the Lansdowne as ever, yes.
The Lansdowne pub in Clifton.
In Clifton at starting at 8:30, but you need to get there early or call me on 07954 147 464 if you'd like to reserve a ticket.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. Well, here's what's going on in the world today. It's Jess Sparks. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 11th of June, the Supremes Tribute Act, the Substitute Supremes, will be performed at the Tunnels in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on the 11th of June, the Madness Tribute Act, Nuttiness, will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Rick Mayall. This is the official, unofficial England World Cup anthem 2010, and it's titled Noble England.
Dear friends, once more to raise up these walls with our English cheer. When the whistle blast blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood. Disguise fair nature with hard, even force. Then lend the eye a skillful aspect. Set the teeth. Oh, gentlemen in England, bend up every spirit to its full height. On, on, you noble English.
On, on, you England, you noble Englishman. Come on, you England, you noble Englishman. On, on, you England.
Limbs were made in England. Show us here the metal of your footwork. Now swear that you are worth your breeding. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit upon this charge. Cry God a win for England and St. George.
That was Rick Mayall with the track Noble England. For more information and for details on where you can download the track, go to www.nobleengland.com. Moving into Saturday, 12th of June, and there is a benefit gig for the National Autistic Society featuring the Red Hot Trio with support from Aliens Dash 10, The Infirm, and also Haxel at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Also on 12th of June, Kick the Cat will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 13th of June, All the Kinsmen will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, and hopefully, of course, no animals were harmed in the naming of Kick the Cat. What a name. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. The hour is up. Our guest in the studio was John Demearns. Thank you very much. And also to Ed Hill for his time, which has to him. And the features are by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. Secrets and Lies was read by Malcolm Greave. Thank you to Charles Thompson for his football tips. Poetry was from the Bard of Wimble Hill and Dialect Radio, Trevor Carter. And the What's On was Jess Barks. Studio engineers were Alec Milne and Michael Reed. And the producer was Anthea Page. Well, until next week, goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman. Take care and enjoy your week.